Hello, and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluik, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. And today on the show,
we all just agreed that we need to do a snap national day of action where we show we are the loudest voice we possibly can be to say that we cannot stand by while you make decisions that impact our future.
This week, snap protests across Australia erupted against the federal government's gas plant extension in WA. We have all the details. Also, why some Australians with disabilities are dying from preventable types of cancer. And later today,
it's a challenge. What we believe as filmmakers is like, it's a very vast country. And if we strategize and release it in multiple cities, I think there is still an audience for this kind of film.
A new movie about caste and gender problems in southern India will premiere in Sydney. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, South Australia has just released their budget for 2025 to 2026 with a major focus on law and order. The budget aims to provide substantial funding for police and corrections, with many organisations saying there isn't enough support for other preventative measures. South Australia Council of Social Services CEO Ross Womersley spoke with The Wire's Zachary Probert to discuss the budget and what could be improved.
We were encouraging the state government to think about this budget not as a holding pattern ahead of an election in 9 months' time, but really an opportunity to lay a foundation for investing in, you know, driving a community towards inclusion and making sure that all South Australian citizens, particularly those who have the lowest incomes or are faced by some sort of challenge of injustice, actually get the attention our government requires. I think the other thing we were saying to the state government ahead of the budget was that the sector itself, the broader social and community services sector, contributes enormously to the economic well-being of the state. It employs huge numbers of people, and particularly in our regions, it may be one of the big employers in some communities, and so becomes economically important from that perspective. And the sector also builds an enormous amount of infrastructure. But most importantly, the sector delivers a whole range of services that might have previously been delivered by government, or they're services that government knows the community needs and they want the sector to be able to deliver them because they know that they can do that with high quality and good relationships. Now, over the last few years, funding for a lot of those services has not kept pace with the real cost increases that some of those services have been faced with. And so we were also talking to the government prior to the budget about the importance of making sure that the indexation of grants and payments to services actually met the real cost that services are having to meet at this point in time.
Talking about these services, was that part of the budget proposal that you submitted? And what was kind of achieved within the budget for those things that you guys were after?
We also talked about the need to invest in housing that was suitable and available to people on very low incomes. We've long said that investing in public and community housing is one of the best ways that any of our governments can ensure that people on low incomes in our community get access to safe, affordable homes. We also talked about wanting cost of living relief that wasn't just a one-off payment to households, and particularly for low-income households. The challenge that they have is that they can't afford to be able to buy things like solar panels and batteries, which provide enormous protection to people and households from having their expenses continue to escalate when it comes to energy costs. So we were really saying to the government, we want you to think about a different kind of cost of living relief that went to those issues and ensured that we put real help in the hands of low-income households to access energy-efficient technology.
A main focus of this budget was law and order. I guess my question for you, a two-parter, what positive impacts do you feel this will achieve? And I suppose what other alternatives could have been looked at aside from policing?
We continue to say, look, no one's going to argue with making sure that our communities are safe. But South Australia does have a very, very substantial number of police. There have been large investments in police force, and we are thinking about some of the other things. So one of the programs that has been trialled in the last little while and is continued under this budget is a co-responder model where police who are asked to come and intervene because someone appears to have a mental health issue are accompanied by a trained mental health professional in order to try and ensure that the circumstances don't escalate. Now, from our perspective, that's a really important piece of work because police shouldn't be really the people who have to respond in those instances. However, it would be even more important if we avoided people needing to respond at all. And one of the best ways that we could do that is to ensure people with mental health issues have good community support that enables them to stay healthy and to maintain their mental health status in a way that doesn't require anybody or them to be calling on intervention from an agency like a police agency.
That was the CEO of South Australia Council of Social Services, Ross Womersley, speaking with The Wire's Zachary Probert. SNAP rallies erupted across the country this week with hundreds of climate activists convening in outrage and opposition to the government's Northwest Gas Shelf approval in Western Australia. In South Australia alone, at least 120 people, including conservation councils, nature campaigners, and politicians, met outside state parliament calling the Labor government to refuse Woodside's Northwest Shelf and Browse project. The Wire's Emma Watsky attended the rally in Adelaide to find out more.
With little warning, in the early morning of Wednesday this week, crowds assembled for several snap actions, unified by concerns on climate. Just one of those was on the step of SA's Parliament House. CEO of Conservation Council SA, Kirsty Bevan, said environmental councils across the country agreed collective voice was needed, resonating strong opposition to Federal Environment Minister Murray Watt's approval to extend Woodside's Northwest Shelf gas export hub in Western Australia.
We all just agreed that we need to do a snap national day of action where we show that across Australia we are the loudest voice we possibly can be to say that we cannot stand by while you make decisions that impact our future.
Quite a few people have turned up here in SA. Do you have any insights into other jurisdictions? What have been the general crowds or responses there?
Each state and territory are running anywhere between now and up to about 10:30 this morning, are running their rallies. I put out messages yesterday after lunchtime that we were holding a national day of action, and you just saw that well over 150 people in Adelaide showed up with incredibly short notice. If this isn't showing that the public are actually outraged, I don't know what will, and we really need those federal politicians to listen.
You know, Australia has targets of zero emissions by 2050, a core part of the Paris Agreement. What's your reaction to these commitments in this context?
Isn't that a great question? Because that is the blaring, obvious kind of contradiction. It is just outrageous. It really is. Particularly as a South Australian, where we're doing all we can to bid for COP31 happening here in Adelaide.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese defended the decision for the extension of the project, saying it is required to support Australia's transition to net zero by 2050. Under the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, the extension approval did not require the Environment Minister to consider the climate impacts of the project. Yet climate remains front of mind for many. Dr. Kate Wiley from Doctors for the Environment says she is extremely concerned about the expansion of coal, oil and gas in the country.
What we are seeing on the ground as doctors is the health of our communities being impacted by climate. When there's a heat wave, when there's a drought, a flood, fire, all of these things impact human health now. And as our planet continues to heat, it's only going to get worse. I think our governments have a responsibility to address this health harm. We know that our government knows that climate change is a health issue. They say it in their own National Health and Climate Strategy. When are they going to incorporate that knowledge into the approval of coal, oil and gas projects in this country?
For citizens and nature campaigners, the decision signals ongoing fears for climate and environmental preservation. And they want to see a stop to these projects. Georgie Hart is a nature campaigner, and she said she was standing in solidarity.
We are standing united in solidarity and also with our Indigenous First Nations people who are greatly affected by these expansions and fossil fuel projects, and particularly this Woodside climate bomb. We're standing in solidarity to say we reject this and we are going to keep on fighting until we see it gone.
I'm aware there is a huge concern for the marine ecology here in South Australia. With these particular projects approved, how concerned are you personally for the ecology of our marine environment but our broader country as well?
Absolutely very concerned and actually devastated, because what we're seeing unfold in front of us has been happening for many years, but it's really coming to a crunch now. We're seeing absolute devastation ecologically around Australia.
I am Kylie Johnson.
Are you able to tell me why you've turned up today?
One cannot do this alone, so we band together like any group. It gives our voice a hearing. I'm here because the Northwest Shelf is going to be encroached with mining for a further 40 years. That's just deplorable in the day and age that we're giving land rights and recognising our First Nations people, the people of the longest living culture on the planet, and we're still abusing their integrity by taking away from the Earth Mother.
Dr. Corinne Ang is the CEO of Asian Australians for Climate Solutions.
We are here representing the Asian community to say no. We have a gas expansion project that's going to extend way beyond 2050, you know, right into 2070. We need to phase out gas. What does that expansion mean? It just means continuing gas, and when we should actually be stopping more expansion or new projects or coal and gas.
The Wire's Emma Watsky with that story. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluwik in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on 8CCC, to our listeners in Bankstown on Connect FM, and to the other side of the country, to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. New research from the University of Melbourne shows Australians with a disability are more prevalent to die from preventable types of cancer. The main reason is because people with disabilities are missing out on potential life-saving screening programs because it's too late or because the programs are not suitable for these patients. Powered Media's reporter Emma Myers asked research fellow at the Melbourne Disability Institute, Dr. Yi Yang, what the research entails.
We looked at studies all around the world, which they compared cancer outcomes in people with disability to outcomes in people without disability. And what we found in that study was that when you look across the whole cancer journey, from cancer screening participation stage at diagnosis to mortality from cancer, people with disability do much worse. This means that people with disability are missing out on cancer screening programs. They are more likely to be diagnosed at an advanced stage. And then after diagnosis, they are also less likely to survive than people without disability.
And what's causing this barrier?
There are many underlying issues causing these inequalities. For example, many people with disability live with a lot of other health conditions. So routine care like cancer screening may not be on the top priority list. So they tend to have a lower participation rate than people without disability. And also buildings where services are provided, medical equipment used to do screening and information provided for screening and other services may not always be accessible for people with disability.
Do you think we need alternative methods for screening? What options are available?
So I think this comes to what we can do, including making the medical equipments for screening accessible. More work needs to be done to make sure that, for example, as you said, the breast screening equipment might not be accessible to people with physical disability, and there will need to be other options. And also, same issues happen with, say, cervical screening. And there are people doing research on how cervical screening can be done or can be made more accessible to people with disability.
In terms of direct or indirect discrimination from people who may not have the knowledge equipped to treat people with disability adequately, what can be achieved there?
So in the recent Australian Cancer Plan for the next 2 years, one of the priority is to train health professionals so that they are provided with support information and training to make sure that they understand the needs of people with disability and also can respond to the needs of people with disability. As part of that, it will help to reduce the discrimination from health professionals towards people with disability, and so that they can make the reasonable adjustments to provide optimal cancer care. But I know it's a structural issue.
What can be put into place that we've already got resources for?
Organizations like Cancer Council Victoria, they have released resources to make cancer screening programs more accessible for people with disability, and with the guidance of how to make things accessible and what are the key barriers people with disability are currently experiencing. With this information, national screening programs, say for bowel cancer, breast cancer, and cervical cancer, can be made more accessible to people with disability, and there are active research going on how to improve people's accessibility to screening, treatment, and cares to reduce mortality. We have existing information pack for the general population, and then these will be made in multiple accessible formats for people with disabilities. On top of the discrimination and also accessible screening and care, there are other things we should do to make sure people with disability have equitable cancer outcomes. For example, designing prevention interventions with people with disability so that these interventions can actually work effectively.
Research fellow at the University of Melbourne, Dr. E. Yang, there, speaking with Powered Media's Emma Myers. Premiering this weekend at the Sydney Film Festival is the first film in the Kannada language to be selected in the Berlinale. A film based in the remote mountainous part of southern India, rarely portrayed in cinema. The film, Tiger's Pond, focuses on a local businessman's pursuit of political power, exploring the complex relationships in a slick thriller dealing with the cultural problems of caste and gender politics. The Wire's Stephen Hill asked the film's director, Nitish Hejibi, whether this film was an attempt to explore the darker forces at play beyond the appearances of tranquility.
Yeah, country like India, we think we don't care about this caste system, but deep down it's the dividing factor, and it dictates a lot of things. And also how power manipulates the people is what I was interested in.
In the film, the character driving the action is a local businessman, Pradu, who is jockeying for a political position in the village. And it's really through this character that the audience witnesses how power is deployed. This is seen in Pradu's relationship with both his assistant, Malabari, and also in the relationship with his brother. Were you interested in using the village environment to look at the hierarchical aspects of India?
Yeah. One, it's not consciously deciding I'll explore this and making a film. Because I live here and I have an understanding of this society, so it comes very naturally to the story. So I was focusing on this story and trying to make a film out of it. By doing that, all these elements of underlining themes of the film, so they come knowingly and unknowingly. It's an understanding of the life that dictates the story.
In this film, you have, as you've got Pradu's relationship with his assistant Malabari, where you have like almost a sort of master-servant dynamic.
Yeah. My thing was like these relations between Prabhu and Malabari and how he manipulates, and Malabari is dependent on Prabhu. This aspect of the relation was what I was interested in. And also I thought like, you know, when a crime is committed, both who commits the crime and on whom the crime is done, it's tragedy for both of them, because the person who commits the crime is also, as a human being, he's declining. So that's also a tragedy. So this aspect I was trying to focus. Marriages are still taboo in the society.
So the other character we introduced in the opening of the film is the shepherdess Parthi. We discover that she is a victim of sexual violence, and due to her caste and disability, is very much an outsider. With she's not afforded the concepts of law or personal dignity that other people would be, and this allows others to act with impunity towards her. And this must be a big challenge, you know, finding a way to depict what is a really serious issue in India, the gendered violence that is taking place in the nation.
Yeah, there are many rape cases. And also, one, it's very heinous crime. And also, my concern was, how can a human being be treated like that? You know, a fellow human being. Actually, this character inspired me to make this film. It's because of Parthi I have made this film.
So this is very much a film that should be seen on the big screen. Yet in India, getting independent exhibition is incredibly difficult. This film will largely be getting an audience from film festivals. How much of a challenge is it getting films like this screened in your home country?
It's a challenge, quite a big challenge. But what we believe as filmmakers is like, it's a very vast country. And if we strategize and release it in multiple cities, I think there is still an audience for these kind of films, because the appetite for good film, good story is always there.
I mean, the other interesting aspect is we're getting Indian films that are getting shown at festivals, but we're seeing a lot of films from different regions and languages. Last year, there was an excellent film, Rapture, that was shot in the Garo Hills of Meghalaya State. With India being such a complex and diverse nation, are we seeing flourishing of filmmakers telling local stories that are vastly different from the sort of big Mumbai spectaculars?
Yeah. That's a very good trend, I think, in Indian independent cinema, because a lot of people coming from different regions, coming with their fresh perspective, as you mentioned, Rapture by Dominic, I think he's a friend. So all these filmmakers from the region coming and telling their story, it's very heartening to see.
So in the 70s and 80s, there was the parallel cinema movement that aimed to produce socially conscious, authentic films about different aspects of India. Yet at the moment, that seems less apparent, with mainstream films really dominating exhibition. I was wondering, is there an underground film scene in India that provides a space for independent cinema?
Independent cinema is mostly dependent on the festivals. In mainstream or popular culture, I think, you know, the 80s or the 70s, these films by Govind Nilani or Saeed Akhtar Mirza, they're not coming out. These very sensible and socially relevant films with an aesthetics. It's a very rare combination nowadays.
Director of Tiger's Pond, Nitish Hejibi, speaking with The Wire's Stephen Hill. And that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ, and Radio 4EB in Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you same time next week on your local station. And if you'd like to listen to any one of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. I'm Tony Pankaluik. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.